All right, is everybody comfortable, happy, and everything and stuff? Fantastic. Really, really wonderful to have you all here. And it's wonderful to see old faces and new. It's good to see some of the crew here. It's very, very nice to see you. Hi, Josh. Hi, everyone. Very lovely to see you. So it's a very, very important time of year. And we've had Rabbi Tatz come in, and he's been given a shiur. And I'm pleased God also doing this now. The whole point of it is that you should have some kind of really important, powerful Seder. And John Jeremy Rubin is going to go. This is the special door monitor seat. Yeah. If you sit in this seat, you have to be door monitor. So the concept here is that you should get something really powerful, really important for the Seder. Okay? You should have something that comes out of it. I just want to dwell on that for one moment. Oh, good evening, good evening. it's actually the only evening of the year where we all get around a table and we have to go through a set script. A very set script. So the set script can get very staid, especially year after year. And you're like, you know, who's going to stand on the chair? Who's going to go Manish Tana? You know what I'm saying? Which, of course, we'll do, you know. And it can get something like, what's the point of it all? What is actually the point? Something that I've been focusing on the shiur, which I've been given, is that the hiddenness of the messages that are in the Torah. Things that you would not necessarily see when you look at concepts that are buried very, very deep within. And I'm going to try, please God, there's a lot of material to get through, please God, tonight. I'm going to try to reveal two major concepts tonight. Okay, so here's the double bill. I'm going to recap over the last year that we did, which was the first part in the series, which is the concept of bread being a symbol for livelihood. Okay, that's the first thing I'm going to do. And the first element of that is I'm going to talk about this thing called the Shulchan, which I think probably is the most misunderstood thing, object, certainly in all of Torah. I'm just going to just dwell upon that for about 10-15 minutes, because I've given like a whole hour about that, but just basically to recap, for those that were there, it'll be recap. For those that aren't here, stop me if you don't understand anything. If you don't understand anything, just stop me and go, what? Okay? So can we just have maybe just a bit of a practice? can you stop me and say, I'll just say the word splidge? Okay, someone stop me and say what?
What?
Brilliant! Splidge, the word splidge, right? Against the word splidge. So that's the first thing I want to do. The next thing I'm going to do, apart from talking about all these like embedded secrets in symbols and stuff in the Torah, is talk about a Kabbalistic concept to do with the answer that we give to the Rosha, the wicked son who sits around the table. Okay? It's quite a Kabbalistic concept. I'm going to try to go into it, but again, if there's any point you turn around and go, what? You just stop me and go, what? And I'm here, you know what I'm saying? Like, I know you've got pledges to go and things to do, but if there's any concepts, anything like that, I'm here to help. Okay? I'm here to help. Okay, is that so good so far? Everyone okay with that? Comfortable? Clear? And Jeremy Rubin is door monitor. We'll wait for Jeremy Rubin to come back. All right. So the first thing I want to discuss is the concept of bread. And as I said last time, I just come back from a trip in Poland. Nobody here was on that trip in Poland, no? No. We just came back from a trip in Poland where we went round to Auschwitz and Birkenau and Krakow and Prague and all these. Come on in. And Prague and all these places. And one of the things that we saw that were painted on all the shul walls was this object. Was this object, which you kind of don't see very much. This is called the table. The table, right? And it was in the sanctuary, in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, and in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle as well. And one of the things that I think that we kind of lose in our general Jewish education is understanding the concepts behind things. So I'm just going to run over some of the general concepts. Again, it's a bit of a recap. But I'm going to, for the individuals that weren't there, that's, you know, I will go as easily as possible, but just stop me if you don't understand anything. So, first things first. Whew, Colin, do you want to give the shiur? Do you want to talk about the bread? Colin knows all about the bread. Yeah? No? You want to talk about the bread?
I'll let you.
Okay, I'll talk about the bread. The concept of bread, putting bread on the table, what does putting bread on the table mean? This is an open question, by the way. Anyone can answer. What does it mean to put bread on the table? It's a euphemism.
To provide.
Where do you think the term putting bread on the table comes from? It's very interesting that we actually have something called a shulchan, which means table, which all it has on it is bread. It's a very interesting point. Our sages teach us that this symbol of the loaves, these were 12 loaves of bread, by the way, stacked up in two rows of six. I'm going to show you more pictures of exactly what the loaves look like. Stacked up in two rows of six actually symbolise the concept of wealth. And it's the specific kind of wealth that God wants for you. And it's a specific kind of wealth that will make you happiest. Interestingly. So these two rows of bread are lined up on a table which is made of acacia wood, lined with gold, with all these kind of ridges and rows. And the breads were stacked up on like shelves that you can't really see. I'll just show you. They had like these gullies which were laid into knocks inside of these wooden tubes. And the bread was just like rested on those slats inside these tubes. So basically, now by the way, we discussed last time how big the bread was. The bread was about the size of one of these tables. Each loaf was about, up until the end of Colin's sitting, was about that big. And it took two people to carry each loaf. Right? Two people to carry each loaf. There were two loaves. Two loaves were stacked on two at a time. You push two off with the two that you're putting on. So you know what? Let's just do this. You be a loaf holder. Okay? And you be a loaf holder. Okay, and there are two loaves over here. When Jeremy and Colin push the loaves on, the two that were on there fall off. With me so far? And that was done in two stacks of six. So far is so goody. Everyone with me up to speed so far. This was done every Erev Shabbos. This was done every Friday by two Kohanim, two priests in the temple sanctuary. So far so good? Any questions up until that point? Okay, great. Let's talk about... You've been great loaf holders. Special badges. Okay, so let's talk about the table very quickly, and then hopefully we get on to the mystical things in the Haggadah as well. The table, by the way, these breads... It's very, very important. This is actually the key of the entire shir. Rewind. The breads were made of solid matzah. It was unleavened bread, according to one attitude in the Gemara. So these 12 loaves, which are two stacks of six, stacked up two aside, right, were made of solid blobs of matzah. With me so far. So we had the lots and lots and lots of matzah stacked up in the temple. Let's talk about the table for 1 second. The table itself was made like this. It's a little bit of a diagram here. It's very difficult to understand this without diagrams. It's made like this, like a table of four legs and then a tabletop. And it was made of acacia wood. Acacia wood is an evergreen tree. The reason why acacia wood was used was twofold. One is we're not allowed to chop down fruit-bearing trees because they give you fruit. And acacia doesn't produce fruit. That's a Torah law. The other is that an evergreen tree is only busy taking sap and stuff out of the ground in order for its own nourishment. It's not giving over any fruit. It's for itself. And therefore it has enough power to send out green leaves all year round. With me so far? Any questions on that? That's a symbol of livelihood. What God wants for your livelihood is that it should be an ever-fresh, ever-growing, ever-green source. Because the table that you're going to put the bread on is what you're doing. The bread is the money you make. With me so far? So now the bread's starting to symbolise the actual wealth, and the table is symbolising how you get the wealth. How you get the wealth has to be it shouldn't be a cyclic panossa. One shouldn't enter into a livelihood which only works for 3 months a year. That shouldn't be your sole panossa. You should be involved in something which is constant and ever-growing, evergreen, always involving output. With me so far? That's the evergreen aspect. That's why it's acacia wood. The next thing that's done is that the whole thing is plated in gold. The table looked gold. The question is, why is gold? Gold is a firm metal that is bent round material to gild it, and it is very pure. God is telling us that you have to have a firm panossa, a firm livelihood, and that the livelihood, the kind of whatever you're into money-making wise, should be pure. It should have a pure base. This is the best way to look for a job. Look for a job which is going to be ever-growing, as it were. There's always going to be opportunities. And two, it should not have any corruption or anything negative in it. If it does, it will harm your long-term happiness, even if you make a lot of money at it. It's a very important point. So much so there was actually a little crownlet, a little crown that was made around the tabletop. Don't know if you can see that. I'm happy to pass this book around in a moment. But on top of the tabletop, they made a little crown. And wherever we see a crown, anywhere, from a king's head all the way through to these objects, it's always a symbol of separation. God needs to tell you, or the symbology of this is telling you, that whenever you're involved in a livelihood, you might turn to something immoral or dishonest. So you have to put up a crown to prevent you from falling into that trap. And that crown was actually made of the gold itself that was raised around, which showed its purity. So the basis of a livelihood, the basis of what matzah is, we've got to get to, we've got to string it all together, right? Stick with me, folks. The basis of what you're going to give over, the basis of the bread on your table, has to be pure, solid, and ever fresh. With me so far, am I doing it okay from last week? I'm not going as deep, but for all the people that were there. Okay. The next thing that has to be discussed, and I'm just jumping now, is to the actual loaves of bread themselves. This is what the loaves of matzah, now by the way, matzah is bread. When you make the blessing on matzah, the matzah, it's lechem min haaretz. Okay, it's bread. Matzah has a status of bread. So this is what the matzah bread looked like. It was like a bit of a square kind of oblong thing. Can everyone see from there? I'm maybe trying to... They were like boxes on the side like this. And they had little horns that went in like that. Okay? So I'm just going to show you. There's some different views of what the matzah looked like, but you can see generally what it looked like over there. This is how it was formed. So I want to discuss the shape of this matzah versus the shape of our matzah, just for a moment. Let's just take that away. Thing is like this. When the matzah was baked, it was baked two volumes. Two volumes. One volume that keeps an individual going is called an isaron. Okay, it's about 4 litres of flour. 4 litres of flour is how much an individual goes through an entire day. That's how much manna fell during the 40 years. With me so far? I'm running over this material, okay? So to get to the main bit, I have to do this. Now, when the breads were baked, it made this huge, huge loaf. Now, does anyone here bake bread by any chance? Anyone here bake bread? Bake bread? I don't know how big a loaf would be if you put in 8.5 litres of flour. Pretty big loaf, right? That's a rather large loaf. 8.5 kilos of flour, something like that. It's really, really big. Mm. That's how big these loaves were. The key is that 8 is double 4. It's a double measure. Right from the start, when you're involved in making bread, you make it with 2. They were baked 2 together. They were taken out of the oven 2 together by 2 people. They were put on the table by 2 people. There's a concept of brotherhood. If bread symbolises money, the way to use money is to be involved in brotherhood, is to be involved in a community. This is what's going to give you the greatest joy. Now, something about this bread, which is very, very important, is that it had arms which went up. The way they made it, it was like flat to start with, and then they bent it up. So let's say it's flat like this, they bent it up like this. So they were like walls. And indeed, the walls went up, that if you were to fold them in half, it would almost touch in the middle. That's how high the walls went up. So the concept is, how do you use money productively? We're talking about money. This is money. You use money productively by holding up your brother or your sister. Holding up a community. I.e., each loaf of bread, which symbolised money, was saying that the way it was being used was to literally put its arms up and help out someone else. This same concept of brotherhood. You bake them 2 by 2, you take them out 2 by 2. There's no concept of individuality as yet. We'll get to it. No concept of individuality. The concept is of brotherhood, togetherness. So much so, after they were baked, they had little horns, little blobs of square dough put in on the inside corners of the box. So that really, apart from looking like a box, it then did this. So the top of the matzah bread actually had like little feet that would support the next bread that goes above it. So it's doing everything it can to help up the next loaf of bread. With me so far? So that's just, it's pretty out there. Pretty out there stuff. Most people aren't aware of this, and it's very important to be aware of this, especially for Seder, as we'll see in a second. Now, by the way, an important point is, if everyone's holding up everyone else, what about the top two? If you got a whole society where everyone's helping out, what about the two at the top? Because there's these guys, which are also trying to, you know, put their arms out to help someone, but they can't help anyone. Who is that group in society? Who are those in society that cannot help anyone else? But I'm not talking about street, like, just in regular society.
Underprivileged.
The underprivileged. Those that need assistance, right? So these individuals, it's interesting, there's two ladles of incense that are placed on these two top loaves. The idea of incense is that something smells good, it smells right. When you smell something, you say, it smells fishy to me, it doesn't smell right to me, it does smell good, it doesn't smell good. The concept of an incense, especially frankincense, which is what was in there, which was a tree resin, which was totally pure, i.e. the concept of purity, was put on those two individuals. Those two, what they represent in the community. Those two individuals represent a community, everyone else in the community supporting them. So the guys at the bottom are supporting the next. And the guys next are supporting the next up. And the guys next are supporting the next up. And the people are supporting the next up. Until you get to the top. The top level of the community are those that are being supported. Those are the individuals that give justification to everyone else below them, that they're all givers. So therefore, those two are awarded, as it were, these two spoons of frankincense. Now, I'm jumping over this material very quickly. We can go into this very, very deeply. But this is the concept. So let's just have a quick look again at the concept of the matzah and the concept of the table and see how that brings into to what we're doing. And then I'm just going to talk about individualism, socialism, and then we'll finish up this topic. So it's like this. When we eat matzah around the Seder table, we're meant to be thinking of a very important concept of livelihood, of physicality, of comfortability, of wealth, of a comfortable lifestyle. That's something we're meant to be thinking. That's something which a lot of people don't think about, but that's the actual essence of the matzah. That's what it's there for. That's what the matzah's doing, as we've just discussed. We'll get back more to that. The way that you make a livelihood should be ever fresh, like acacia. It should be gilt-edged. It should be 100% of a pure source. Shouldn't be dishonest. And the money that we earn, apart from sustaining ourselves, remember the bread folds in half. Half of your money, as it were, can go to you. And that whatever's auxiliary, as it were, can go to helping out someone else. So that's why the breads are pushing up. With me so far? So the breads that are symbolised, stacked up two by two, by the way, there's 12 loaves, which is symbolic of the 12 tribes of Israel. All Israel's helping each other out. This is the concept of the table. The concept of the table is that you have a symbol of livelihood, of material welfare, of monetary input, which is being used to better a community. Any questions based upon that? At all? Go for anything? Sure. Yeah.
You mentioned that according to one attitude, it's matzah.
That's correct.
So are there other opinions that say it's...
There is another opinion to say that it could have been challah, that it could have fermented. But most opinions seem to say that it was matzah. It was indeed an unleavened mass of dough. That's the majority opinion.
What's the significance of that as opposed to being challah?
Excellent, excellent. Good question. Everyone got the question? Saying, if these 12 loaves over here being stacked up, why should they specifically be unleavened bread as opposed to fluffy kind of bread that you get in Brackman's? Yeah? With me so far? So the answer is like this. Matzah is unleavened, which means it isn't puffed up with hot air. The symbol of bread being puffed up with hot air is being puffed up with its own arrogance. At the end of that, if you say someone's full of hot air, they're full of themselves, they're full of basically nothingness. Fluffy bread doesn't really have a very big substance. The substance that should be there to support the community should be strong, should be dense, should be deep. So too, matzah has nothing but the flour and the water that's in it. It's not puffed up and baked light, it's real deal. So therefore the symbolism of that is going on your question, is that the whole concept of the matzah should be that as the community supporting each other, it shouldn't be done with arrogance. It shouldn't be done with self-aggrandizement. It should be done with the feeling of just lowliness, like matzah is like a lowly bread. It's not puffed up with itself. Do you feel comfortable with that answer? Yeah, sir?
Just to clarify, you said about how the legs at the top are symbolic of the underprivileged. So the legs at the bottom are therefore the ones that...
They're the
foundation. They don't need material.
No, the ones at the bottom are the founders of a community. They're the ones at the very, very base which allow an entire community to exist. That's the concept behind this. Now, there's many more concepts. I could go into many, many more concepts. I'm kind of skimming over the surface here. But there's many concepts, especially that the fact that each loaf, even though it's holding each other up, was separated by these narrow little galleys that I was talking about. When you're going to give to your brother or your sister, when you're going to give to a community, you have to have a level of separation between you and that person. If you blend into someone else, you can't give to them, because who's you and who's them? So you have to have the concept of an individual self. You have to know who you are. What's my bank account? Right? I can't give you someone else's bank account. Well, we're all one. We're just one big people. Right? I take his bank account and give it to that guy. Right? I'm being a community member. It doesn't work like that, right? That's not going to work. You have to know what's mine, what the boundaries of me, what the boundaries of someone else, and know that I'm giving from me to someone else. Otherwise, it's not called giving. So that's why you have to have this little separation between each loaf. Yes, there's a community. Yes, there's togetherness. But you have to have a sense of self. So each loaf is completely separate and doing all it can, not only to sustain itself, but to help someone else. A community like that is going to be an amazing community. A community that has income, welfare, social support, that is ever-flowing, ever-green, gilt-edged, completely free of any negativity, even with crowns around it. You do things like you make laws to make sure we don't get into any trouble. You make beautiful bread, which is always done by two. The essence of it is the concept of brotherhood. Yeah, everyone's got their own individual place. That's a structure of a society. That's a societal structure. It blends an individual and it blends a society into a harmony that has always got physical comfort and growth. Daniel, you want to ask a question?
For the opinion who says that it was fluffed up challah, what's that, the significance of that?
According to the significance of if it was challah, the concept is something which is inflated, as it were, or blown up out of proportion, still in order to help one's fellow. That's why we generally say that it isn't. I.e., even if you use a grandizer who says, serve God b'chol me'odecha, with all your might, and b'chol levavcha, with both your hearts. What's the two bases? The Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov. According to the opinion that it was indeed challah, according to the opinion that it was leavened bread, then you should also serve him with a leaven in your heart. It's a mystical concept. But even help people with the Yetzer Hara. Basically, if you have a Yetzer Hara that says, I just want to give 50 quid because other people will think I look good, still give. Still give. Because that guy needs a sandwich. So if you're going to get whatever you need, basically, the whole concept, basically, okay, I'm going to take a detour. Yizkor on Yom Tov and Yom Kippur, right? Yizkor, the concept of Yizkor. This is a remembrance of those that have passed away. Why was Yizkor invented? Does anyone know? The famous Yizkor that we have on Yom Tov, the people come in and they say a little prayer, and all the kids come out, and people that have lost a relative or parent or stuff like that stay and say a memorial prayer. Why was Yizkor developed? Does anyone?
Comfort.
Any other questions? Any other answers? Yeah? What do we say at Yizkor? What generally do we say? What do we say in the prayer? That we're going to donate something to charity. Or that there's going to be an appeal that's going on with it. Say the rabbis that to get someone to give charity is so important, we'll invent something called Yizkor just to get them to come to shul, to hear the charity appeal, to give the charity. Huh. That's the challah. That's leaven done. I'll do anything, just give charity. What am I going to do? The rabbis, they needed to bring people together. They had a community. There were people that were needy in the community. When are they going to make an appeal? Yom Tov. That's when appeals are allowed to be made. You're allowed to make... There's a whole question. Are you allowed to make business transactions on Yom Tov and the Shabbat and the Yom Tov? The answer is, you know, you're not. But you're always allowed to collect for charity. You're allowed to have an appeal. Indeed, even when you sell off the aliyot, the call-ups to Torah, you're allowed to do that because eventually it's going to go to charity. But if the only way you can get them in to give charity is by inventing a prayer that they want to come in to give, do it. That's when these would be challah. But generally, the overriding opinion is you shouldn't serve it like that. You should do it out of humility. That's matzah. Flatbread. Do you feel comfortable with the answer? Yeah? Is everyone comfortable with the answer? Did that answer? Yeah? Comfortable so far? So good? Yeah?
What's the significance of the challahs being changed every Erev Shabbat?
Oh, fantastic. This is such a fantastic question. What's the significance of the challahs being changed every Erev Shabbat? Two very important things. One is, the challahs that came off, a miracle happened. As I just said, the challahs that came off was fresh and smelling as good as it just come out of the baker's oven a week later. Interesting. So they pushed off and they were given to the priests to eat. The key is that when you're involved in a livelihood which is ever-growing, which is guilt-edged, which is involved in brotherhood, which has a good balance of your individual versus society, it's always going to be good. It's always going to be fresh. It's always going to taste good. So God's symbolising, you get this right, Your bread, which is the symbol of your sustenance, will never go mouldy. It will never go stale. You'll always feel when you're eating very, very sated, as if it's just come out of the oven. It's a special blessing that God gives if you live right. Amazing concept. Do you feel comfortable with the answer? Everyone cool with that answer? Yeah? Any other questions up to now? Oh, fantastic. Okay. All right. So we've got to understand that when you're sitting around the Seder table and you're eating matzah, the whole point of eating matzah is you're eating, by the way, sorry, I'm going off now. I remember doing a psychological study. I studied psychology. And one of the things I studied was an individual, they're these weird serial murderers. Sorry, I'm really going off, eh? Huh. We're tuning in later at 101 PM FM. I'm going off. There was this really weird serial murderer. It's called Bundy. His name was Bundy. We had to do a psychological profile on him. And there's a few others that we had to study as well. And one of the things that these serial murderers like to do, apart from chop up their victims and kill them in the most terrible, nasty ways, was to eat them. Ooh, right? And I don't know whether or not and some people like bake them, they eat them. Hold on, it just happened recently. There was a Holocaust survivor living on a road and he smelt the smell of burning flesh. He went to a police station about 4 or 5 years ago, walked and said, I came from Auschwitz, I know the smell of burning flesh, there's a guy on my street burning human flesh. And the police found that guy and he had all these bodies under his garden? Don't you remember this at all? There was the top headlines, it was this guy, he'd been put away. He used to eat people. He was burning their flesh in barbecues and eating them. Yuck! Right? So this happens. Do you remember this 4 or 5 years ago? Oh, it was horrendous. The whole thing, I remembered it because this Auschwitz survivor, he's the one that got him. He was walking down the road and he smelt the smell of burning flesh. So he went to the police station. He said, I know that smell. You have to check that out. It's one of the things for the Holocaust deniers as well that it brought up. He definitely knew the smell of burning flesh. And he was right. They brought the sniffer dogs in and he was right. Why would someone want to eat someone else? Sorry, it's a weird question, but I'm throwing it out. Why would someone want to eat someone else?
Because they're sick.
Because they're sick. What is the concept of eating?
To absorb their essence.
The best way you can take hold of something, the best way you can grasp something, the best way you can own something in the world, is by eating it. Once you eat something, you can't get closer to it. How can you get closer to anything than eating it? These sick individuals that eat people are weird, and they are definitely this. They're going to interrupt me because they're actually eat people. Excuse me, I want to get close to you, so I will now eat your flesh. So no, that's not the message of this lecture. It's not the message, but there is a concept that eating something. Take it easy there. Eating something is the best way to get grasp of it, because it becomes part of you. It becomes part of your body. With me so far? When you eat the matzah, you're meant to internalize the concept of what matzah is. That's the concept. You eat it. God says you have to have at least a mouthful. On first night Seder, we have to have a mouthful of this stuff. And when we ate the matzah back 3,320 years ago, that was the food that forged us into a nation. That was the food that did it. With me so far? That was, everyone was walking out with little bundles, and then suddenly we became the people of Israel. It was all through matzah. It was through the concept of having this food, this sustenance, this welfare. That's the last shear all wrapped up. Any questions up until there?
Just one. Can I just ask you why you said when they pushed the two off, they fed it, the Kohenim ate it.
Yes.
Why just them? Why not anybody else? And this particular reason.
Yeah, two
and
reasons.
Why just two?
First of all, why did we push him off? That's one question. Why push off and not take them off?
Right.
So that not for one second was the table ever without bread. Not for one second in your life should you be wanting for income. So you push off the last batch with a new batch. You don't ever have to say, I'm going to go nothing with my account at all and wait for the next payday. And then it's so holy, such an attitude is so holy that only the priests could eat such a symbol. That's why it was specifically given to the priests. Do you feel comfortable with that answer?
Thank you.
Fantastic. All right. So we're all sitting around the table, and we're going through this Haggadah, and there's one guy around the table that pipes up. One guy around the table that pipes up. And he goes, what are you doing? What are you doing? Have anyone ever around the table been here, ever been asked by someone either that's not so religious or someone that's not Jewish, why do you do the things that you do? Ever been asked that?
The
people are curious as to why we do things the way we do things. What's the best way to answer someone? What do you think the best way to answer them is?
Tradition.
Just say it's your tradition. That's one way.
With a question.
That's, sorry, what?
With a question.
You could either answer them with a question if you're Jewish. You can answer them, why not? Why shouldn't I do it like this? Do you have a better idea? Is it cheaper? So we're Jewish after all, you know what I'm saying? The Kippur is expensive. You know, is there a cheaper alternative? That's a very good answer. Why do you do it like that? Because I have no cheaper alternative. That's one very good answer. Maybe I should start using that. Really, the best way to answer someone's question on this score is actually to explain to them, to reveal to them the very depths of why you're doing it. It's not just to go, because it's a nice thing we do, because we're doing it for a number of years. That's obviously an answer. But the best way to answer is actually get to the very nitty-gritty of the point so they totally understand it. Does that make sense to everyone? Is that the best way to answer it? So they walk away going, wow, I really know why they do that. You know, someone asks, why do you wear one of these, or why do you do that? And you really get onto all the concepts. They go, wow, that's great. That's fantastic. Can I have one? You know what I mean? Fantastic. What a great idea. Once they walk away like that, that's the best way to answer it. Now, that would be the best way to answer a question. Do you agree with me? Everyone agrees with me so far?
Not always. No.
Hmm? Not always. Yeah. But is it not the best, the deepest way? No. Okay.
Well, it might be that I would put someone off because you've given them too much information.
Obviously, you have to. Each individual needs to be answered at their particular level. But the best way to possibly give over an answer to someone is that they're literally living and breathing the answer too. If that's the case, we have a bit of a problem with something in the Haggadah. We're going to read the Haggadah, right? And we're going to get to this very important point over here, which says the wicked son says, what does he say? He says, what does his service mean to you? To you, he says, but not to him. Therefore, because he's excluded himself from the community, he's denied the foundation of our faith. It's pretty intense. Consequently, this is the answer. This is the ultimate answer, folks, okay? This is what we've tuned in for. This is what it's all about. We've learned all about matzah. We've learned about income. We've learned about money. We've learned how to be in a society. What are we going to say to him? We're going to explain it to him this time? We're going to blunt his teeth. Going to break his teeth. Punch him in the mouth. And then say, it's because of this that Hashem did for me when I left Egypt, for me and not him. Had he been there, he wouldn't have got out. Now, I'm sorry, like, based upon our answer that we've just got, that's not such a wonderful answer. Is that me? Or is that not such a wonderful answer? You break his teeth, and then you don't even respond to him, you turn around to everyone else around the table and go, well, had he been there, he wouldn't have got out of Egypt. Now, does that answer the question? I don't know, I have problems with that. I don't think that's such a wonderful answer. So far, so good. Does that not sound like a wonderful answer? Obviously, it's pretty good because it's in here, right? But there, it just sounds as if it needs something to be discussed. With me so far, any questions? This is really, really important. There's two points here. The first point is that we don't actually answer him directly. We answer everyone else around the table. Had he been there with an attitude like that, he never would have been formed into the people of Israel. The whole attitude of what matzah is an attitude of brotherhood and togetherness. When he turns around and says, what's that going on with you? He's saying, I'm not part of your brotherhood. I don't care for brotherhood. I don't live my life like that. My income, my social comfort isn't like that. So what we'd say is, well, then you would be part of our group. That's what we say to everyone else around the table. But we say something far more important. We say, blunt his teeth. Break his teeth. Now, does that honestly mean that we have to punch him in the face? Do you think that's what it means? First of all, it's forbidden to punch anyone in the face, by the way, according to Torah law. Okay, just by the way, just to point that out, everyone should come out of here with one message. What did you learn? We can't punch people in the face, and we shouldn't eat them. That's it. Yes! That's it. You've come out with such great... That's great. You know, if just that alone is worth it. I think before we answer the question as to... What, you know, punching him in the face and blunting his teeth, we have to ask a very, very deep question. And that's, what is a tooth? What is a tooth? So, obviously, we have to turn to an anatomy book for that. And we'll have an anatomy book right here. So, teeth, right? This is a human skull. Okay? So, teeth grow out from a couple of bones. Okay? So anyone here into this? Anyone here into anatomy? Yeah, okay, yeah, what do you do?
I do optometry.
Okay, great. So would you like to... What's this bone called? Over here.
I don't know.
Fine, okay, we'll skip that then. I do eyes.
This is the maxilla.
Very, very good. That's the maxilla case. The area, it's the era of specialisation. So I only do this. Okay, and in the mouth. The maxilla, that's right. This top bone is called the maxilla, right? And the bottom bone, where the bottom...
Mandible.
Is the mandible. Excellent. Okay, so you see here, these are two bones. Do I have another picture on the side? Yeah, okay. Just got this. So we've got the top bone here, which is the bottom of the skull, basically. And we've got a bone which is jointed called the mandible. So now when we speak, just there's a very important thing. Puppets, when puppets talk, notice it's the hand that moves the puppet. It's the top bit that moves, right? That's not so in a human being. We don't talk like this. Whoa. Okay, so really, it's this bit. It's that we're still here, and it's the bottom bit that moves. With me so far? Okay. Should I do that one more time? Okay. With me so far? Here's where the Kabbalah comes in. This is where we need to go to the mystical sources. Okay? Check this out. Part and parcel of Kabbalistic study is the shape of Hebrew letters and how they do stuff. So we're going to do a shape of a Hebrew letter. Let's do a maxilla at the top and a mandible at the bottom. With me so far? That makes the letter...
Kof.
The letter Kof. And notice, Kof has two forms. A regular Kof and a final Kof. What does a final Kof look like? Like that, right? With me so far? Watch my mouth. This, if you took out my flesh... and gave it to Mr. Bundy, and he would eat it. Freaky, right? So, good joke continuity, though.
Yeah.
Okay, so, right, rip off my flesh. And, right, and then you would see the maxilla at the top, the mandible at the bottom, right? And that's the letter Chof. With me so far? Now, there's two Chofs, right? There's two Chofs. There's an open and a closed. Watch this, folks. It's an open Chof. A Chof opens and closes, like a mouth. How cool is that? How cool is that? Indeed, the Chof is called in Kabbalistic literature the oral cavity. It's a cavity. Wait. Cavity. Okay, put that on the shelf. Now let me ask you a question. Has anyone here ever been to like a Kabbalist? Like a big heavy rabbi? You have? Mm-hmm. They're pretty scary people because they can look at you and they know what's going on. Let's explain how that works. What is a tooth? A tooth is something which grows out of your bone, and we have different... Anyone a dentist here, by the way? Can you help me out here, dentists? No dentists. Okay, oh, next dentist. There's a few different types of teeth. There's the incisors at the front. There's the canines, which are like the pointy, fangy Dracula ones, okay, for those that aren't dentists. And then there's the molars, which look like little shins, like little cusp teeth, which grind. With me so far? Three types of teeth. What do these three types of tooth do? The incisor grasps food. The canine rips food apart. Okay? And then...
One more time.
And then the molar, what does the molar do? You move food to the back of your mouth, and the molar?
Chews.
Check this out. What is the first teeth that we get in our lives? The incisor. Then? What do we get after that? Huh?
Yeah.
And then? The molar. And then when we get older, we even get more molars, what the Gentiles call wisdom teeth. They're onto something. Let's get there. You can see how a human brain is developing by looking at how the teeth are developing. Check this out. Remember we had that letter Chof? Remember we had the letter Chof that opens and closes? What happens when a tooth, which by the way, a tooth is symbolised by the letter Yud, according to the Kabbalah, and a Yud is the letter of Chochmah, of wisdom. It's the first letter of God's name. And God is very wise. He started off building with wisdom. Now we got that letter Chof, right? Push through into the Chof an upside down letter Yud. Upside down because it's coming in from the brain, which is above the maxilla. So wisdom is coming in from here, which is where my brain is, by the way. All the way, I'm going to see it over there. Brain is in this bit, skull. Okay, and there's things going on in there that make us think. And then that comes through into our mouth and we talk. So it's coming in upside down, because really it's coming in upside down, from the top down. So we have a chof, and then you bring in an upside down yud into the chof. With me so far? Gosh. What letter would we have? A pay. Very good. Who said that, by the way? Very good. What does the word pay mean, by the way, in Hebrew?
Mouth.
Check this out. Check this out. This is awesome. We have an oral cavity, which is the letter chof, and coming into it is a tooth in the form of a letter yud that's pushing into the chof. And that makes the word mouth. The very letter means mouth. This is a pair. This is what a mouth is. It's a chof. It's an empty. It's an empty mouth. With some yud of information coming in, represented by teeth. Different concepts are grasped in different ways. The first thing you need to do with the concept when you hear it is grasp onto it. That's your incisors. The next thing you need to do is rip it apart. That's your canines. And the last thing you do is chew it over. Think about it. Those are your molars. And with age and wisdom come another set of molars right at the back in the very depth of the mouth that you're thinking very deeply. Those are called wisdom teeth because they're the teeth that have come from the maturity of your wisdom. Who are with me so far? Okay, that's pretty intense. Okay. Notice the pay has two forms just like the chaf, because it's the same letter. It's got an open and a closed. A final pay at the end of a word does the same thing, because the mouth opens and closes and the tooth stays the same. You with me so far? Is everyone with me so far about this tooth thing? Yeah, any questions? No? Then we'll continue.
I have a question.
Go for it.
Is there any significance to the fact that you said you take, you get the information, you bite it, do all that, yeah, and swallowing it by finally taking it in?
That's a very nice idea.
Yeah.
Taking it into yourself after you've chewed it. I love it.
This
is Richard Basker's special novelette on this particular ship.
I thought that was quite good.
By the way, this answers questions. Why do we have two sets of teeth? What are our two sets of teeth, by the way? Milk and adult. Why? Why do we have that? Why not six sets? Why not like sharks? Sharks are constantly making teeth as they break them off. How can we answer that from what we've learned?
Is that the two thing that you're saying?
We have two statuses of wisdom in our lives. We have the years of our childhood, which is symbolised by one set of teeth, because that's the wisdom coming into our mouths. But we lose those, just like you lose looking at the world like a child. Do you understand what I mean? You don't look like the world like a child does anymore. Then when you grow up, you get a new set of teeth, and that's called adulthood. That's a ramification of your adulthood. So, Sam, you look a bit confused.
But every stage in life is developing.
That's true, but you know what? We just have childhood and adulthood. We have childhood, squidgerhood, putcherfutcherhood, and then adulthood. If we had childhood, squidgerfoot, and putcherfutcherhood, and then adulthood, we would have four sets of teeth. As a ramification of the fact that we go through four different... Yes, you're right. Every day's a learning experience. Absolutely. But generally, there's two types of wisdoms we have. You ask a child, why is the sky blue? And you ask a scientist, why is the sky blue? They're going to give you two very different answers. Because they're looking at the world differently. Those are represented by a shedding of one wisdom and a replacement with another. Isn't that awesome? Where are you going to get that information? Isn't that out there? No? No. Okay, no. You're right that as we go through, we develop. But the development goes through two very distinct stages, childhood and adulthood.
All right, just one.
She brings it to both of us, yeah.
One's more like intellectual and one's based on more sensory.
One's more developed. Children have less teeth than adults. We have more development of our wisdom.
So what's the difference with the shark?
Sharks are animals. That's why. So sharks are always developing teeth, because that's their job. They don't have wisdom to develop. It only works with human teeth. Every other animal is given the tools that it needs to make its living. That's specifically, that's something on Parshas Noach. there was all kinds of adaptation with different animals and stuff like that. Going to that, yeah.
What about people as they get older losing their teeth?
They lose their mentality. As you get older, unfortunately, you get a bit gaga. Why does it? So the teeth also come out as a sign of that. Mm. Have you noticed that? When an individual gets older and they start losing their mental sharpness, their teeth, which is representative of that, go.
So it's false teeth, false wisdom.
No, I mean, if you haven't pulled out, listen to it. Okay, that's for further discussion.
By the way, I take it that swallow thing is just like a nice thought.
No, I like it. It's a very nice thought.
But it doesn't mean anything.
No, I'm not saying it doesn't mean anything. I think it's a wonderful concept.
Oh, right.
Yeah, okay, you chew it up and then you bring it into yourself. Fantastic. Yeah. Lawrence, you had something? I don't know. No, I think you can't make individual generalisation like somebody's more prone to decay, which means well they're not living in a water fluoridated society. You know that means oh gosh their wisdom is going to get holes in. I don't know if I'd go there, but we're talking generally in the concept of the pay, the half, the. Okay. Yes.
What's the significance in that you get your second set of teeth when you're quite young? You're not an adult.
What's happening as you get the second set of teeth is when you start getting the changeover. A child, when they start losing their teeth, isn't an adult yet. No. But that's when their mentality is developing. Going back to this Kabbalist concept, a Kabbalist will look at individuals, they can see by a child's teeth that's developing what different faculties of the brain are actually sharpening, are actually starting to come through. The beginning is the incisor, when you lose those. If the child gets his adult incisor or her adult incisor quickly, you can see they're going to grasp onto things relatively quickly. Right? So it isn't as if it's development. It isn't as if, you're right, they're not 30 and then suddenly they'll just fall out of teeth. Oh my gosh, he's having his teeth fall day. It's teeth shed day. So all the teeth fall out. And then could you imagine that? Like on the train. So like, oh, sorry about that. I just have a teeth shed. Yeah, I'm just getting my new mentality through. Could you imagine? So it's like, it just happens one day. Oh, I feel white. Could you? Weird, right? So it doesn't happen like that. It happens gradually. I'm so glad you asked that question because now we know that. So it happens gradually over time. Gradually over time. So too, the tooth development happens gradually over time, which frankly, for those socially embarrassing circumstances, is very good for us, because otherwise you would have all that kind of blood coming out of your gums and like, yeah, sad. I'm going too far down the blood thing. Yeah, go for it.
I don't think the majority of people do have a full set of teeth, right? How would the client be able to tell from the teeth between different people that have...
No, all I'm saying is when he sees a child at that stage that she's talking about going through development of getting new teeth. You can see what stage of mentality, I'm going to be with you, Colin, what stage of mentality is developing.
Right, but not between different people that have all their teeth.
I don't understand the question. Sorry, what more time?
I can understand if it's like a young kid and an adult that have two different sets of teeth.
Yes.
But say me and half the people in this room have like a full set of teeth, how would the Kabbalist be able to tell apart from...
Oh no, you wouldn't. Again, Kabbalists aren't magicians, they aren't prophets.
Right.
What they're doing is reading a system. They have a scientific knowledge, a wisdom, which is very, very powerful. So at different points, and I'm giving over some of these elements to you now, at different points you can understand what different things mean and symbolise and why they're there. Right. So I wouldn't be able to look into someone's teeth and go, wow, you're very good at that. I'm saying overall, the global development, you'll be able to see globally what's developing mentally, which is an amazing thing, without having to do psychometric testing. You could do that from teeth. Yeah? Colin.
I just wondered if it's only teeth that a Kabbalist analyse, or whether it's...
No, every single part of the body. Yeah. Every single part of the body has some connection to something else. That's why it's there, according to the Kabbalah. Yeah. Teeth have this, I'm telling you now, the tooth connection, why we have two sets of teeth as opposed to three. How they develop, why we have different types, what they symbolise. Obviously, there's a physical element, learning in school that you grab onto grass with the incisors and rip meat with a canine and stuff like that. Talking spiritually, why the teeth have those different shapes. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So far, so goody? Okay. Back to the Haggadah. What do we say to the Rosha? What do we say to him? We blunt his teeth. Okay, everyone's now up to speed. Yeah, Jeremy, up to speed now this. What does that mean? What does it mean we blunt his teeth? What does it mean we bunch his teeth out?
Mm-hmm.
isn't. His wisdom's wrong. What do we say? We said that when you blunt your teeth. When, by the way, do you blunt your teeth? Can I blunt your teeth? It's a self-inflicted wound. It's a wound due to lifestyle choice. He's or she is unhappy with their life because of the way they're living it. How do you tell them what to do, what's doing? You blunt their teeth. That doesn't mean you take a sledgehammer and you beat them in and then you eat their flesh. Right? It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean you become a serial murderer. It means you explain to them how the way they're grasping the world, symbolised through their teeth, is wrong. And then you turn around to everyone else around the table and say, a philosophy like that would never have got him out of Egypt. He'd never have been part of our group. Does everyone get that? I'll do it again. One more time. How does the Haggadah say, brilliant, what's the best answer? Remember we said, how do you answer a question? And we defined the best way to answer a question is to make the person live, breathe, totally understand the answer. 2 + 2 = 4 because of all the concepts of 2 and what 4 means. And now they really understand. Not just because. That's the way it is. When the Russian turns around and goes, why are you nuts? Why are you sitting around the table having these flatbreads, you know, and leaning sideways and drinking wine? You're nuts. What are you doing? The best way to answer him or her is actually to say that the way that you're viewing and approaching this is intrinsically wrong. Blunt their teeth, the way they're grasping the concept, and show them, rebuild their teeth. Indeed, the Gemara says you should blunt their teeth, the Talmud says, blunt their teeth so they can't crunch the matzah. Now we get a very deep understanding of that. Why did the Gemara say that? Don't let him or her approach the concept of matzah, which is brotherhood, unity, society, and income, wrong. That's all encoded in this one line. That's one line of text. This is one line of the Haggadah. That's the entire concept. Now, who's the ultimate Rasha? Who is the ultimate Rasha in the Pesach story? Pharaoh. You don't get worse than that. Big, evil dictator, whip, nasty guy, not into people. Especially Jews. Right? He's really mean. So he's a Rasha. Check this out. With this we'll close, and I'll take any questions, and we're done. So far is it goody? Everyone up to speed? Pharaoh was a wicked, wicked man. He was an evil man. He got women doing... You know, one of the things he did was he got women doing the job of oxen in Egypt. So women who were naturally not necessarily as strong as men, he would tie them with a yoke and get them to plough fields. So not because he needed that, but because he wanted to break the Jews. He went above and beyond the call of duty. He didn't just have them as slaves, you know, pour me a glass of water. He was really mean to them. He bathed in their blood. He was nasty. He's a Rasha. How do you answer a Rasha? Come on, guys. How do you answer a Rasha? Blunt his teeth. What does that mean? What does that mean? Sorry? Tell them his philosophy. Now, I would say to such a... He's just like Hitler. Such a guy, you'd crush him, just squish him. You'd go... Oh, God, just go... just push him straight down and squish him. That's not the way God wanted to teach him. That's not what God wanted to do with him. What did he do? He sent 10 plagues. 10 plagues. This is a very, very interesting point. Thank you. It says like this. It's very, very interesting. The Maamar Lewes brings down the following. The Maamar Lewes says as following. The Egyptians worshipped 10 gods. Did you know this? Did you know the Egyptians worshipped 10 gods? No. Interesting stuff. God number one was the moon. The moon. The moon was a god. Water, they believed, was controlled by the moon, responsible for the tides. So they used to go and pray to it's the lowest of all their 10 gods, by the way. So they used to have shuls, churches, just to the moon. So what did God do? He sent the plague of blood, which changed the water. They all went to shul, they all went to church, prayed to the god of the moon, go, heal our water, O great moon god. Nothing doing. Sorry. Oh, that's interesting. God number two was Mercury. They believed that influenced everything that lived in the water. Frogs came out of the water. That's number two. Oh, God of Mercury, save us from the frogs that are coming out of the water. Nothing's going on. God number three, right, was Venus, which they believed influenced beauty. Lice are the most disgusting thing. Oh, God, save us from this disgusting thing. No, nothing doing. How do they know that all these clothes are... Oh, that's such a good question. Did you know? Nice. Ancient Egypt had telescopes.
What's the question?
How did Egypt know all of these things existed? I'll give you a better question. Can I give you a better question? I'm Jewish. Answer question with a question. Has anyone here been to the pyramids? Have you seen the pyramids? The big three pyramids, the giant pyramids. There's a big one, a smaller one, and a little baby one, which is still really, really big. Did you know that the size of those three are directly in proportion to the distance from the Earth of the three stars in the belt of Orion to 10 decimal places? I'll just recap. You know the belt of Orion, Orion, like up in the sky at night, there's like stars, and then there's like a little belt that goes across the belt, little three little stars? Well, they don't look like three little stars if you view them side on. One's there, one's like about that many light years away, and one's over there. With me so far? So they're actually quite a distance away, but when you look at them, they just look as if they're three. Well, that distance, if you take a ratio, is the exact difference in the height of the pyramids.
Height of distance.
No, height, relative height. So the biggest pyramid is the star closest to the Earth.
Right.
The next pyramid is the star furthest away, and the little pyramid is the star furthest away. They nailed it exactly. How did they know that? That's an absolute fact. NASA have established that, 100%. How did they know that? How could you possibly know that? And then, and beyond that, if you go more into the pyramids, which is a pet subject, if you go more into the pyramids, they had channels and shafts that led into the main burial chamber where pharaohs were buried. And at solstices, the different equinox and solstices, stars lined up into those dots. And they believed that their souls were shot through to those stars at different times of the year. Could you imagine building it? It's a miracle. That's why it's one of the wonders of the world. How do you get it exactly like that? With windows that, like, at different times of the year, line up with stars that fit exactly in those windows. You try building that. And that warning, they had no cranes. So, Bob, put it up. These are slaves. We built them. They go, we were hammers, nails, chisels. How do you do that? Wow. They had slabs of rock which no crane today can lift. How do you get them up there? How do you do it?
We built them, or they?
The Jews built them. They didn't go out. Pharaoh wasn't like, phew, good old day building pyramids today. Go on, He had a workforce of billions of slaves, of which of them were Jews. The Jews were busy building the storehouses and silos.
Did Jews design them?
That's an excellent question. Yeah, you know what? I could go on for another hour just about that, but I can't. I would love to go into that concept. Not clear.
At least you're honest.
Not clear. It's linked to the Tower of Babel. The whole thing is this architecture. The Tower of Babel, they found the foundations in northeastern Iraq. Tower of Babel is like, it's not so much, the foundation isn't so much smaller than Belgium. It's a huge spiralling tower that went up. Remember, according to our sources, it took a year to climb up. A year to climb down, there were hotels on the way to acclimatise to the altitude. You had a hotel. Welcome to the 3,000-foot hotel. At this hotel, there'll be only 7% oxygen. Enjoy your cup of tea. That's what it was. We don't realise, just, we've lost a lot of this understanding of the world. How did I get to this? I'm not. I'm talking about lost. I'm lost. Oh, right. Pyramids. What? Come. What?
Plates.
Plates. Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. Plates. Oh, the sun. Oh, how did they know the planets existed? Yeah.
Thank you. That all comes back to your question.
There we go. I'll just carry on then. Okay. So then they believed the sun influenced desert animals. What did God do? Send the plague of wild beasts. They went and prayed to Mars, which they thought influenced body warmth. And then what did they have? Pestilence. Which was an imbalancing of body warmth. Jupiter was meant to balance out body fluids. So they had boils which were dry on the outside and wet on the inside. Then the Egyptians believed that the gods dedicated to Saturn could influence anything to do with ice. Then came the hail with fire. The zodiac was believed to influence all living creatures. Then the locust came. They prayed to the zodiac, didn't go away. The outer sphere was responsible for progression of day and night. and there was darkness, and the ultimate sphere was the sphere of the intellect, and that was responsible for a special gift that firstborns had. God then killed the firstborn. Why did God do that? The answer was, he was blunting Pharaoh's teeth. When you explain something to someone, you don't smash them in the head with a sledgehammer. You don't kill them. You go, excuse me, why do you do it? That answers that question anymore. Imagine if I was surrounded by anyone got any questions. Got a question? Go on, day. It's going to be your lucky day. Could you imagine that would be a really intense shit? Everyone's bloodbath. You know what I mean? If somebody, it's like everyone's there. Wife comes in, how's the shit? Everyone had questions. It's a, mop them up. It's just one quick way to lose punters. You kill them. No, we don't do that. That wasn't the way. I mean, God killed the firstborn. Why did he do that? He's blunting Pharaoh's teeth. The whole point is Pharaoh, you think the moon runs the world. Blood. Pharaoh, you think, what is it? Mercury, Venus, the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the Zodiac, the outer sphere. Each one you're going higher and higher. Each one I'll meet you, and each one I'll tell you you're wrong. All this God is doing for a Hitler. How much more is he doing for you? How much more is he doing for you? He's willing to do this for Hitler. Notice, one of the things that God was busy doing, Erev Shabbos, which was a busy time when he was creating the universe, was making the mouth of the donkey which spoke to Bilam. It's a Mishnah. Why? So the donkey could turn around to Bilam, who was a wicked, cruel man that wanted to kill Israel, and by the way, he slept with his donkey. And the donkey said, why are you doing this? All that for Bilam, who was like a Hitler. God would busy himself for that, for such people. How much more is he going to busy himself for you? That's breaking the teeth of the Rosha. That's what it means, blunt his teeth. Even take someone as fair and love him. Care for him. Care for her. Understand their question. Understand their query. Realise it's a real question. Want them to have the best possible answer. Go through all the variables and give them the right answer. God was willing to do that for Pharaoh, who was not a nice man. You with me so far? That's I'm going to come to your questions. That's blunting your teeth. I just want to say, all this came out of one sentence. And in blunt his teeth, say, can't chew the matzahs. These are the matzahs, the concept of a good, happy, healthy society. A good group of people doing things right, the right way. Don't approach that wrong. When a Rosha turns around and says, what is all that nonsense? Love him or her. Say, I hear you've got an issue with that. Let's take it step by step. Blunt the teeth which are the essence of your wisdom and allow you to regrow a new set. A new wisdom. A good wisdom. A deep wisdom. A wisdom of matzah. Not fluffy. Of powerful, intense knowledge. Of living and breathing that's ever fresh and ever ready to go. That's the message of the Rosha. That should be when you're sitting around the table and you go, whoosh, that's what's going on in your head. Now, I guarantee to you, if anyone doesn't have, come back to me. Come back to me. Now, I'll even be an aid. I'll be a witness in heaven. You hear what I'm saying to you? If you're thinking of that and you don't have an incredibly powerful Pesach experience, if you realise I'm eating the symbol of everything, this is what built our people. This is how it's meant to be. And I'm crunching it with my teeth. With the way I grasp onto the world. That's my pay, my chof, with me. Yeah? If an individual turns around and says, well, what is that? What's going on? Allow their teeth to be reformed. Take out one set, put in another. You with me so far? Okay. Questions?
You never said how they knew about all the planets.
Yeah, okay. Well, I pointed that you're right, because, you know, it's a big topic. They had telescopes. They knew a lot. They were so much of their life. Remember, one of their gods was a zodiac. That was the ninth of their 10 gods. They were so masterful in their astrology that even the Torah, even our Bible, explains that they were arguing, with Moses, saying, when you're going to leave this country, you're going to go out to the star Ra. you're going to go out to a particular zodiacal sign, which means blood. They were so, which was true. At the end of the day, it was the blood of circumcision and the blood of the Paschal Lamb. They didn't know that. They thought it was blood of our deaths. They didn't know. That's all, by the way, horoscopy, anyone that reads stars and charts and things like that, it can only tell you general variables, not individual things. This is, where do we learn that? From this very verse. They said, you're going out to blood. That's absolutely true. How? Don't know. Don't know. It's dependent upon you. I would love to answer that very, very in depth as to how they knew about stars. We just don't have time now. It's beyond the scope now. So
how does the man know everybody getting from that they were there 10 gods?
It's brought down in about 15 different sources, and he's merely quoting
even
it.
Even like secular Egyptian.
Secular Egyptian. If you go into the hieroglyphs, you'll see their temples to Ra and Isis. Orion apparently was an incredibly important constellation for them, so much so that's why they built the pyramids like that. They felt as if it was a super nexus of energy to channel in from Orion.
So, if Bob Rush, I was reading that sentence about being teeth being blunted, and they wouldn't be inclined to go and search as to the reason why it actually says that in all of these different like concepts. So, why isn't it a bit more explicit in order that a Rush can...
Two incredibly important questions. Is everyone here, Samantha's question? Has everyone got Samantha's question? Why is it not more explicit? There's two things. One is, it's amazing the Rosh is included. Let me point out one very important point. How many children are there in the Haggadah?
Four.
Wrong. There's five. There's the guy that's not around the table. The Rosh is at least connected. Says Rav Uziel Malevsky, the shin of the letter Rosh looks like and stands for the word shoresh, which means roots. At least he's round the table. Once he's round the table talking, he comes right after the chacham. He comes right after the wise one. Before the tam and before the she'ani yadaya. Before the simple one and before the one that doesn't know how to ask. Once he's round the table and engaged, or she's round the table and engaged, talk to them. It's your job to talk to them. It's not explicit. They don't understand it explicitly. They just have inner questions. You have to explain it to them. Someone who doesn't ask, if they're not even, then they're not even addressed by the Haggadah. Once they're not attached enough to be around the Seder table to that extent, you don't have to address them. Comfortable with that? It's a powerful argument.
You've lost them in other
ways. Sorry? Yes, you've lost them. And you aren't required to answer up their questions. You don't have to go out into the street and find if they've got questions. They at least have to ask you. Someone stops you in the street and go, why do you wear that on your head? Answer. But to find a Jew in the street, but to start knocking on the door, are you Jewish? Do you want to ask me? Why do I wear that on my head? I don't have to do. The God is it's a paradigm of education.
So there comes a point, therefore, when you have to cut the losses and round them off.
Yes. That's a very separate subject, and I'd love to go into it, but we don't have time for that. Any other questions specifically on this particular topic? You know what? Yeah, okay. Everyone, by the way, is free to go if you've got things to do and stuff like that. Just feel free, totally free, and just go, oh, sorry, I've got to go to Poland. I've tracked a plane to Bulgaria. I'm sorry, check in. Like that, just feel totally comfortable and confident. But I'm happy to answer any questions that you feel. If you want to go, you know, if you want to take a break and go, that's absolutely fine. Does anyone want to go now? Yeah, okay, fine. So you know what, we'll stop here. And anyone that's got any additional questions, just stop and I'm here to answer them. Shkoch, it's really wonderful to see. First of all, I wish everyone a really, really wonderful Kosher Pesach.
Yeah.
And I hope you got something beneficial out of this.